Since the release of his first volume, Shrapnel and Sheets, in 1996, Mario Petrucci has been a singular presence in English poetry. He has a PhD in optoelectronics, which the internet tells me is the branch of a technology concerned with the combined use of electronics and light, and another degree in environmental studies. When I think about Mario's earlier work, I can't help thinking of one of those knobbly models of a molecule. There are clumps of concerns, such as war, history, and poems about love and family and about his Italian heritage, all sort of connected with one another. Latterly, in volumes such as I, Tulips, which was 2010, Anima, 2013, Mario has moved into an exquisitely condensed modernist expression. Underpinning all his work is a scientific impulse, which flavours works such as Flowers of Sulphur and Heavy Water, but this is accompanied by a continuous, soulful engagement with the divine. This autumn sees the launch of a new collection from Cinnamon called Afterlove, and I'm delighted to welcome Mario Petrucci to our podcast.
Lovely to be here. Thanks, Peter. That's very generous.
So when we're recording this, we're all recovering from coronavirus, or at least the lull between the first and second waves. How have you fared, and has it affected the way you work?
I think it's a return to the natural condition of the poet, isolation and difficulty. Yeah. With shards of sunbeams. I felt part of something that's fascinating and troublesome. It's great territory for a poet to be in.
I do sort of fear that kind of tsunami of lockdown poems that are going to come.
Yes, I'm not writing those. I'm writing counterculturally. I'm writing love poems.
Okay, so one of the things we're doing in this podcast is poking a stick at the relationship between science and poetry. So how do you think a background in science has informed the way you think about poetry and the subject matters you're prepared to take on?
Yeah, that's a kind of enduring question for me. Niels Bohr said we are suspended in language. And of course, there's different kinds of language. There's the language of mathematics, the language of poetry, the language of politics, the language of accountants. There are all these different languages we're immersed in and that we subsist in. And science has a very particular way of expressing itself. And I think this all goes back to cubism, relativity and modernism that were broadly coeval. They all had quantum leaps in their understanding of themselves at around the same time. They started looking at themselves. Science started looking at itself through quantum physics. And poetry started looking at itself through modernism. And what I've learned from science in that process is the intensity of attention. The intensity of attention that science gives to its subject is related. It has a kind of kinship with the intensity of attention that poetry gives to its subject.
I have a sort of mental picture of you in boffin mode, forensically pulling apart language.
But that's the thing I learned as a scientist, not to settle for superficial appearances. You can't.
Yes.
And as a poet, I've never settled for the superficial.
Absolutely, and that really shines through your work. Could I ask you to read the poem O Anima from your collection Anima? It seems to be a poem that could only have been written by you.
There's a few words to say about this, because Anima is part of a much larger sequence called I, Tulips, which the book I, Tulips draws on as well. And that was 1,111 poems written over 7 years. And this was a kind of subsequence within that larger sequence. And what that sequence is trying to do, and this book does the same, is to try and work on several levels at once. The quantum idea that everything can be or become everything else. So it's a love poem, but it's also an archetypal poem, and so on. And it's an existential poem too, in its way. O Anima, you ran ahead when magma was just a girl hurled along masculine vertebrae to spill her tresses hotly orange, or part in pleasure there and here her many yellow lipsticked mouths. You blessed the pool where bacteria unthinking Brownian ways through measured light chose instead one day to walk, and continents still fused hip to shoulder, you smouldered on each southern bed dreamy with depth and loosely loved where underwater vents, teethed in druze, sent upwards plumed biota as campfires do by gloomy streams. And even through reptilian doom, you grew patient for me as the Nile for sand or that green-brown rind on crocodiles. You waited for sun and mind to grow me, with every journey hearse to crib become one slow breath. And now I breathe creation in, as though that oxygen were easy on these lungs, received through a look fearlessly ancient from a creature formed not of rib, but water, who found at last air and fire, or as bluish earth in all its seas glares in love upon aerial blues, or the airborne bird ever chooses to keep motionless its egg, or settles in the nest it makes itself with delicate shivers to rest within that perfect fit. Though today I sleep and skit, so sense myself a swallow stalled and brought too soon to ground, who sees thus calls to your sky moving on above to wait for me.
Wow, that's so great, Mario. Obviously, anima is the term used in Jungian psychology to describe the feminine part of a man's personality. Listening to that again, it almost seemed to me like a sort of creation myth of feminine power.
Yes.
We live in a time when issues of identity politics are discussed with increasing passion. Do you feel in retrospect any sort of trepidation about taking on a subject like this?
Not at all. Robert Creeley talks about saying something as it goes. And something that occurred to me this morning thinking about this interview was how back in the 80s and 90s, when you and I used to go to workshops, it seemed that the primary concern of workshops, and this is not to be derogatory about them, was to purify the poem, to make the meaning clear and simple and accessible to everyone. I'm not so interested in that now. I'm interested in complicating the meaning, in enriching it, in making it archetypal, as in quantum physics, allowing it to operate on several levels at once. So you don't quite know what it's about, but you're deeply moved and profoundly stirred by it. I think that's an essential role for poetry outside its other dominant role as a form of high-class entertainment.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying about that time as well, because as a reader, as I'm always attracted to ambiguity now, and that's where you can sort of bring your own feelings as a reader and your own contribution as a reader to dwell in that ambiguity.
Gandhi said you must be the change you wish to see.
Yeah.
And I believe I've learned from him that you must be the poet you wish to read.
You have also translated works by the Persian mystical poet Hafez, which was published by Blood Axe, wasn't it? And the Hindu text, the Isha Upanishad, amongst other forages into the territory of spirituality. Ever since I first read your work in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, there's always a strong spiritual current there. What's the relationship for you between, you know, that scientific empirical impulse and an open awareness of the divine?
I don't see a conflict, but I don't necessarily see an obvious kinship.
Oh, that's interesting.
Rilke said, in rough translation, what is your most pressing injunction, if not for transformation? Poetry does a different kind of transformation to science, obviously. But science transforms. It transforms raw data into insight. Poetry does something else. And my writing is an exploration of what that something else is, which I can't quite pin down. One aspect of it would be to modify silence, to modify silence. And I sometimes think that music creates a silence at the end of piece, at the end of the piece of music, in a similar way that a poem that really moves us creates a silence at the end of the poem. And I think that is the piece of music, that silence. And it is the poem. The words led you there. Yeah. And I think Hafez does that. The Isha Upanishad does that. It leads you to silence of a certain kind, a rich, complex, empowering silence.
That's that was actually, weirdly enough, going to be my next question to you about that silence. And because I found that quote on your website about, you know, what is the point of writing a poem if not to modify the silence? There was a wondrous little poem in I Tulips, which I really love, called I Rather Love, which dovetails quite nicely into this notion of silence.
The other thing I should say before I read this poem is I write a lot of ecological poems that are not obviously ecological poems, and that do something that I find in some ways poetry doesn't seem so concerned about doing anymore, which is to be concerned with its own sound.
There's enormous musicality in I Tulips, I think.
It's very rare to meet a painter or sculptor who isn't interested in paint or clay, the medium itself. So it's difficult to kind of help readers, it sounds patronising, but to help readers to see that the sound is at least as much of the meaning of the poem as the obvious message, the kind of syntactic message. I rather love not things, but what lies behind these, the way a year is sometimes glimpsed past ear of corn, or December come out of blue to one who knew only sun. Perhaps such are best unsaid, so all might speak of corn and sky, or strip December's down to black scaffold trees, where life sings and sings to death each silenced thing.
I just love that notion of something hiding behind other things, or that just glimpse moment. It seems to be kind of archetypical description of a kind of mystical experience, or that moment of transcendence.
And it's also a metaphor for what poetry can do, which I'm not saying has been lost, but I think we've got to grip that with some kind of passion, that there's a role for poetry in terms of not being marketable, but being profound.
When I was thinking about the extent of your work, I was thinking there is a strand of poetry at the moment where people have, to put it charitably, fewer hooks to hang their coats on. Whereas you've got such a generosity of engagement in terms of your subjects.
Well, let's face it, poetry isn't that fashionable. And once you move outside the performance circuit and rap and so on, youngsters that I meet who are interested in poetry are interested in more performative aspects in it in general, not all of them. So poetry has an ongoing crisis in terms of who it speaks to and how it speaks. And when it comes to voices, I believe that the more voices you have, I don't believe that you should find the voice that's yours and purely and wholly yours and work that to the nth degree. I feel that voices can inform what you want to look at and speak on your behalf, and you speak on their behalf.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, just speaking personally for a moment, I sort of view it as a kind of sub-personality thing, that I write everything from horror stories to plays to poems to whatever, and they're all giving vent to different parts of me. And this idea that you know, you should condense everything that you are into one expression or one mode of expression is just alien.
Well, T.S. Eliot said a long time ago, humankind cannot bear very much reality. And I sometimes wonder whether ecology can't bear too much humankind, and whether we can't bear too much of ourselves.
We live in a time when the idea of truth is under siege. Certainly with figures like Trump seem to almost celebrate their lack of a moral compass. And none of us kind of write in a vacuum. Do you see yourself as responding to this at all, or is the current chaotic situation something to just slam the door on?
Well, I used to respond to current events in a very immediate and forthright way, through a poem and through articles that I've written, papers, and I used to be more involved in the media, BBC, radio, television, so on. But to be frank, I found there wasn't too much interest in what a poet had to say about such things, unless there were that handful of poets at the forefront of the discussion, of the conversation. So I've gone deeper than that. I'm more interested in looking at the eternal concerns, why we still feel we have to fight wars, why we still fall in love, what it is to be conscious and alive, the wonder and the incredible complexity of the universe, which at its heart is witheringly, beautifully simple. And those are the concerns, I think, that will outlive us and enrich us and nurture us in the most difficult times. That's not to say that poetry can't be obviously political. It can. But I find that not anyone's listening too hard to me there.
Well, hopefully some of our current difficulties will dissipate and great poetry will remain great poetry. What's next for you, Mario? You've got this new collection called Afterlove due this October from Cinnamon. What can we expect from that collection, and can I prevail on you to read something from it?
Well, you can prevail. I don't mind that at all. I wanted to end with a kind of simple poem in one sense, but also a poem that discovers itself as it's written. That's the thing I didn't say about I, Tulips. All the poems in I, Tulips, the 1,111 poems, I never knew where the poem was going in any of those cases. I let the poem unfold as I wrote it. And this kind of enacts that. And it's looking at the rituals between father, me, and his young daughter through food. Daughter. I cut you. One tiny circus of cheese. Cheddar, stronger than blood. I trace in a circle at the tip of a blade and place upon your trusting tongue, calling it moon, to seize and bring you to this moment, all but gone as soon as made, as though far more than mud and dust could sing us, as if this softest planet I rest forever almost within your red space of mouth were, now I see it, host.
I love how such a small incident can unpack so much.
The universe is a hologram. Everything's present all the time, everywhere.
Yeah.
We just don't necessarily see that in our day-to-day living. And that, for me, is one function that poetry has, along with philosophy and art of other kinds and other genres, to remind us that we're not singular atomistic beings, we're connected. And look at the basic medium of poetry, metaphor. The basic tool of poetry is metaphor, that everything can be everything else. Everything is connected to everything else. That's at the heart of something that poetry reaches for me.
Well, that's a beautiful way to end our conversation, I think, Mario. Thank you so much for joining us, and I just wish you well with this new collection, Afterlove.
Yep, with Cinnamon Press, out on 5th of October. You can pre-order. There's the marketable bit of me coming through there.
Yeah, just at the bitter end.
Yes.
And to continue the marketing theme, we've actually got a very special offer from Mario. What he's doing is making some of his back catalogue available free. We put a link in the podcast description and just click through that to find out more. Never say we don't do anything for you. No, I should mention that Mario and I were chatting a few months ago now, just prior to the launch of Afterlove, which has been published by Cinnamon, and that's a cracking collection too, so I would point people towards that. But you know, all of his books are really worth investigating.